in Portland?
Yes, I will be as brief as possible. Zenith Energy started transporting oil by rail in like 2014 when they had a permit and a former asphalt terminal. They have sort of violated a number of agreements that they've had with the city and state, including DEQ, along the way in order to continue their fossil fuel operations. StreetRoots reported in August that public records showed city officials, including Commissioners Carmen Rubio, Dan Ryan, their staff, Bureau of Development Services people met with Zenith Energy and its PR firm in June of 2022. And right after that meeting, the city rubber stamped a key permit, the LUCS, Land Use Compatibility Statement, to expand their fossil fuel infrastructure right along the Willamette River. So the main thing here is that while Zenith was suing the city for its prior denial of that LUCS, city officials took this tour planned by Zenith's PR firm, quickly changed its position to greenlight the permit and then promote this transition to what Zenith calls renewable diesel, which is sort of a greenwashing term for fossil fuels.
So now in the present day, what kind of permits does Zenith require to operate or to expand?
They got that LUCS in 2022 in October. It was sort of gifted to them by Dan Ryan. The city was winning in court at that time in front of the Land Use Board of Appeals as Zenith was trying to sue the city. But right after that, they ended up getting that LUCS. That LUCS permit is a really key thing that Zenith needs in order to get this air contaminant discharge permit from DEQ to be able to continue its operations there. And so that's sort of the central point for activists now, is that since that LUCS was potentially, done under some interesting circumstances, that DEQ should examine that process before they give them the air contaminant permit.
What does I mean, maybe it's in the name. What does the air contaminant discharge permit mean exactly?
It's sort of how much how many sort of pollutants DEQ determines to be okay. And so they have different classes of these based on how much is going to be emitted from Zenith's practices.
So where is Zenith at in the process of getting this permit?
Zenith has the LUCS that they needed, and they, I believe in November maybe of last year, had actually gone to DEQ to apply for that air contaminant discharge permit. So they're essentially waiting on that. I think often from DEQ that is just a something that they just kind of rubber stamp and let go on as usual. It's not usually very controversial.
Well, you write that protesters gathered at the DEQ office on November 17th, calling on the Environmental Quality Commission to take action to stop Zenith. What do they want this commission to do?
These advocates, Breach Collective, sent this letter to DEQ, which was signed by a coalition of 34 different people from different organizations like Columbia River Keeper, Willamette River Keeper, 350 PDX, Portland Audubon, Sunrise Movement. And so there was this broad coalition of neighborhood groups that showed up, people of all ages, to DEQ for the Environmental Quality Commission public hearing about this issue. So I talked to Naomi Markell, a 19-year-old organizer with the Portland Youth Climate Strike, and she told me that they had hosted some climate activists from Texas recently who sincerely believed that Oregon was kind of free from a lot of the fossil fuel stuff that they see in Texas. And when she told them about Zenith, people were really surprised to hear that we had like oil by rail coming straight through our city. And through our neighborhoods. She said she dreams of a day when Portland can actually be considered a climate refuge, and that won't happen if this permit is approved. And people continue to expand fossil fuel infrastructure in the city. So this group is asking DEQ to deny the air contaminant permit based on the fact that the city's LUCS process was insufficient, and they have the explicit right to do that. DEQ has the explicit right to do that.
Does the commission seem inclined to do that, to reject it?
It's hard to tell. DEQ, you know, and the EQC are not typically involved in much controversy and might want to stay away from, you know, things that are a little bit controversial. So the, you know, I talked to Lauren Wirtis, is the communications director or manager at DEQ. And, you know, she said that this is not something that, like, DEQ doesn't have anything to do with the city's LUX process. And there seems to be a bit of a misunderstanding in the way that DEQ and potentially EQC are interpreting this, which is that advocates are not asking DEQ to get involved in city process. They're saying that the process that the city used to determine that LUX is insufficient, and it is not a basis for actually them obtaining the permit that DEQ is in charge of, the air contaminant permit.
So for these advocates who are pressing the Environmental Quality Commission to reject this part of Zenith's permits, how strong is their case? Is this the kind of thing that this Environmental Quality Commission has done in the past, rejected things for these reasons?
Yeah, so the Environmental Quality Commission can pressure DEQ to do this. I'm not sure of other instances of that, but you know, EQC like regulates policy for DEQ, and within the guidelines for DEQ, you know, the Breach Collective's letter argues, based on, you know, a specific state laws, that DEQ, there's a statute that gives direct power to DEQ, and it says if DEQ concludes a local government LUX review and determination may not be legally sufficient, the department may deny the permit application and provide notice to the applicant. It's pretty explicit. Activists are calling on DEQ because it's a regulatory agency meant to regulate industry in the public interest.
So what happens if the air contaminant discharge permit does get approved by DEQ?
Essentially, DEQ giving them that air contaminant permit will allow Zenith to move forward with its plan. Its plan is, it has told the city it's going to transition to renewable diesel within 5 years. It is not clear whether or not that is possible, or if that is actually even the intention, because Zenith has a pretty strong history of violating the things that they say that they're going to do. But this will allow them to move forward, continue doing their operations. They are a fossil fuel company, and they will be able to expand their infrastructure. They're adding a couple of pipes on the Willamette River right on Front Avenue. And they will be able to essentially just move forward and continue doing what they're already doing.
What happens if the permit gets denied?
I would imagine there will be some other appeals and more legal battles, but it would at least be a message sent that that these kind of processes are not something that the city of Portland accepts.
Well, right, a lot of this has been city level issues, and now it's kind of going to the state level. What role does Governor Tina Kotek play in all of this?
Kotek is, you know, this is a state agency, DEQ, and she has the power to kind of put pressure on and ensure that DEQ actually follows its own guidelines, its own explicit rules to review the process if it's insufficient. So she, I got in touch with her office, and her press secretary, Anka Matika, got back to me and said, the Governor Kotek has instructed her team to monitor DEQ's review of the permit application and the land use compatibility statement. And then sort of mentioned the Land Use Board of Appeals again, which is an interesting thing to keep an eye on, because a lot of the political leadership is pushing it into other departments where it seems to be an appropriate place for a legal battle. The thing to keep in mind is that this was much of the problem is that there was already a legal battle in the Land Use Board of Appeals just a few years ago. And that's actually the problem that a lot of advocates have with this whole thing, is that it was in court, the city was winning, and then scored an own goal, just giving a permit back and then at the public's expense.
how dire could the impact be for the Linton neighborhood and Portland more broadly if Zenith continues to grow its presence?
Zenith is representative of a much larger issue globally. In particular, especially right now, the idea that transitioning to renewable diesel is an effective way to address climate change. So there's little evidence that renewable fuels are materially better for the environment than traditional fossil fuels, and the dangers are nearly identical. So in Portland, a lot of people live in what advocates call the blast zone, close enough to oil trains that might derail in their neighborhoods, like we saw in Mosier just a few years ago, that nearly, you know, blew up a school. Even if the trains don't derail, there's a coalition of physicians, and one of them, Melanie Plout, spoke at the EQC the other day, saying that, you know, pollution near people in those neighborhoods contributes to negative health impacts like asthma. And then there's this ever-looming Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. The Multnomah County report from 2021 showed the potential for explosions, fires, mass pollution in the Willamette and Columbia Rivers in the instance of a megathrust earthquake. And all of that carries the same risk with renewable fuels as it would with traditional fossil fuels. That report said that the impact could be similar to the 2010 Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico, right there next to Forest Park. But the real issue that impacts people of all demographics, though, same as ever, those impacts are felt most acutely by people in poverty and people of color, due to the neighborhoods where those trains are transporting these fuels.
What are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this story?
These processes are generally pretty boring. That I understand that. they have pretty wide impacts. So there's maybe nothing more confusing and boring than a LUX or a ACDP and DEQ and stuff like that. But these are, you know, this is where the oil companies who have all kinds of funding are able to go in and continue their operations that are literally the cause of climate change. And, you know, community advocates are continually getting together to try to fend off these dangerous fossil fuel companies.
If listeners are interested, where can they find a copy of your column for themselves?
The best way to find Street Roots is to buy one from a vendor. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips, and they are in your neighborhood regularly. You can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts? Anything we didn't get to cover?
No, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. That was Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots talking with me about his latest column. It's called Earth to Oregon: Portland Climate Advocates Ask State Leaders to Deny Zenith Energy a Key Permit. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
This is KBOO News In Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. Healthcare affordability is an increasing problem in the United States. Physicians for a National Health Program has published a summary of Medicare Advantage overpayments that shows how so-called MA plans are making huge amounts of money from taxpayers and Medicare enrollees. To learn more, KBOO's David Rosenberg spoke with James Kahn, a retired professor of health policy at the University of California at San Francisco and an editor and blogger at Health Justice Monitor.
Medicare Advantage overpayments, what's going on there? I haven't heard such good things about Medicare Advantage to begin with. Is this just something on top of that?
It is. There are a lot of problems with Medicare Advantage, but one of the biggest problems is that Medicare Advantage, that is to say the Medicare Advantage plans, which are private insurers, have figured out how to manipulate the payment system to earn lots of extra payments. And I use the word earn advisedly. It's not really earn, it's to capture vast overpayments. And what happened recently is that Physicians for a National Health Program assembled all of the estimates of the ways in which Medicare Advantage plans game the system And the result was a total capture of excess funds. That is an astounding amount of money. There are some uncertainties in any estimate like this, but the amounts are certainly over $100 billion per year. This includes attracting less expensive enrollees, so people who, even when you adjust for their diagnoses, are less expensive. And this comes to about $44 billion a year. In the jargon of my field, it's called risk selection, finding people who are less expensive. Another $20 billion goes toward upcoding of diagnoses. And so people who might have had one questionable diagnosis of congestive heart failure are coded as having congestive heart failure, even though no one's doing anything because it's not really a real diagnosis for them, or it's not a consequential one. So that's $20 billion. And then there's $24 billion in geographic and quality score pay bumps, where these quality scores don't actually mean anything. They're just gamed. They have no clinical meaning or consequences. And finally, there's some technical issues in how traditional Medicare is used to set the payment rates. You add all this up, and the Medicare Advantage plans are bringing in an extra $106 billion a year, maybe even more than that, but conservatively, $106 billion a year. To put that in perspective, that amounts to about $2,240 per Medicare Advantage enrollee per year.
And where's the oversight on this, if any?
Well, I think what it comes down to is that the people at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, known as CMS, which administers Medicare, they're outgunned. They're outgunned technically or legally, in the sense that even though the CMS folks have done some of the best research on these overpayments, they're confronted with legions of lawyers and technical experts in the private insurers who manipulate the system. One example of this recently was that the CMS folks a few months ago proposed an adjustment to the way that diseases are coded to avoid the overcoding, to correct for the overcoding. And they proposed doing this in the first post-COVID year of setting the payment rates. And the insurance companies pushed back very hard. And the result was that the insurance companies, for pushing hard for a few months, got back $10 billion in overpayments that CMS knew about and asked for correction, but lost that battle. And this brings me to the other way that CMS is outgunned, and that is the private insurance companies have tremendous influence in Washington, tremendous political influence through lobbying and donations. This certainly includes the Republican Party, but unfortunately, it also includes many, in fact, most Democrats. They are getting lots of money from the private insurers. And so when CMS is trying to do its job, its oversight job, and they have the technical chops to do it, they are prevented from following through on their technical findings by political pressure from Congress. And so, again, I just want to emphasize CMS has done really good work to understand these problems. And there's a special advisory group that's been around forever called MedPAC, which is the Medicare Advisory Group. And MedPAC also is, you know, convened by the government as an advisory group. They know exactly what's going on. They have done some spectacular research, but getting the Congress and the administration to support CMS in adjusting some of these things is really difficult. I will say also that until PNHP assembled all of these estimates in one place, it's a little hard to add them up. You know, I knew about the risk selection. I knew about the inflation of the diagnoses. And I knew that these private insurers were also getting geographic and quality bonuses. But to see it all in one place and add it up, and it comes out to more than $100 billion a year, more than $2,200 per enrollee per year, it's just stunning. It is an unbelievably huge scam.
Would it be better to get rid of Medicare Advantage altogether?
Absolutely, it would be better. First of all, traditional Medicare, which relies on direct fee-for-service payments to doctors and hospitals, is a much better buy for the taxpayer and for beneficiaries. So we should be doing
more of
that.
You think that conservatives would be able to sell that to their constituents, right? Saving money?
Well, conservatives are very influenced in what they think and say by the insurers. So the argument has been for decades that if you let private insurance companies work within a fixed a budget per beneficiary, it's called a capitation rate. If you let them provide quality health care, they can save money and improve quality. And there may have been a few instances of that, maybe Kaiser in its early days, but that's not how it's shaken out. You look at the performance measures, Medicare Advantage plans in general do about the same as traditional Medicare, maybe better on a few measures. But when people get sick in Medicare Advantage, they have trouble getting care and they leave. That's part of the risk selection problem. So that people get sick, they go back into traditional Medicare, in which it's easier to get care. So they've been gaming the system. But the myth that was promulgated decades ago with limited data and has been counteracted but not dropped, the myth is that somehow or other these private insurance companies can skim off a bunch of profits and still reduce expenditures and improve quality. And they keep saying that. They keep arguing that they're doing that. But this kind of analysis, which shows that actually they're spending huge amounts of extra money, which goes largely into profits. Meantime, there's no evidence that the outcomes are any better. And in some cases will be worse and care will be harder to get. Really, what it says is that there is no advantage to Medicare Advantage. Traditional Medicare would be better, but the real solution, of course, would be to completely revamp the system and go to a single government payer like there are in many other wealthy countries and let the government pay for healthcare, let the doctors and hospitals and other health professionals deliver care and get paid by the government. The system we have now is crazy fragmented. Within Medicare, you have this distinction between traditional Medicare, which could be improved, and Medicare Advantage, which is horrendous in the ways I've mentioned. You also have scores of other government programs and hundreds, if not thousands, of private insurance. So now, it used to be 15, 20 years ago, if you were insured, you could count on being able to afford your health care. And now, being insured is not enough because the high deductibles, it can be $5,000 or $10,000 or more before the insurance kicks in. It's completely inadequate. And then both the private insurers in the job, in the employer market, so the insurance people get at work, plus the private insurers in the Medicare market are creating these narrow networks where there are limited numbers of physicians people can go to. The lists are often inaccurate. So you think you have access, say, to a hematologist or a neurologist, but when you call that person, they're not in the network or not taking new patients or sometimes even not alive. So sometimes these lists include doctors who have passed away. So it is a major scam. This Medicare Advantage piece of it, 100 million, 100 billion plus, is a big part of the problem, but it is also not the whole problem. Very similar phenomena with the job-based insurance. And of course, this doesn't even get to the issue that about 10% of adults are simply uninsured.
Have you taken your findings to Congress yet, or is there an opportunity to do that? Or would it matter, given what you said
that's
previously?
A really good question. I mean, I personally, certainly the relevant congressional staffers are completely informed on all of these issues. I'm talking about congressional staffers from the more progressive side of the Democratic representatives and senators. Certainly there is a critical mass of our elected officials who are support real change, real regulation of Medicare Advantage, and really the most important thing ultimately is system reform to a single payer. Bernie Sanders, of course, has introduced his single payer bill, had I think about 20 co-sponsors, not 100% sure of that number. Pramila Jayapal in the House with her single payer bill had about 120 co-sponsors, so not enough right now to prevail, but very good levels of co-sponsorship. And importantly, polling of the U.S. population shows support for single payer. If you ask the question fairly, if you say, would you like the government to be responsible for paying for health care if your taxes would have to go up, but you would no longer have to pay premiums, deductibles, or cost sharing? If you ask it that way, support is about two-thirds of everyone. So it's higher among the Democrats, and there's actually a surprising level of support among Republican voters when it's explained that way. So there's a continues to be huge interest in this, and of course, I have to acknowledge massive opposition from the insurers and others who would lose out financially. But that's, to me, there are two angles of attack in Congress. One is to improve regulation of Medicare, in particular Medicare Advantage, and to establish some important principles like negotiate for drug prices. And as you and your listeners know, the Inflation Reduction Act that Biden signed into law includes a modest but not trivial element of drug price negotiation, and that's working its way through the rulemaking process. And recently, the initial drugs to be for which the prices would be negotiated were announced. And so that's part of it. But the other part is to keep our eye on the prize, which is universal coverage with a single government payer that would assure that everyone is covered from birth to death with really good insurance. And importantly, with the same insurance. Right now, part of the problem is everyone's got different insurance. So you go to the doctor's office and you spend half of the visit trying to figure out what's covered and what isn't. Maybe the doctor prescribes a medicine and you go, well, that sounds good, doc, but I don't think it's on the formulary for my insurance. And then everyone has to scramble, figure out what other drug might work. All of that goes away when everyone's covered with the same insurance, the same formulary, and the savings, the annual savings in simplified administration of the system are on the order of $700 billion. That's not only getting rid of the profits, but also just making the paperwork an order of magnitude simpler.
That's the problem. It would just be too simple and direct. It makes too much sense. Never work.
That's the problem. It makes too much sense. I hear you.
That was retired UC San Francisco professor James Kahn speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. For KABU News in Depth, I'm Reed Johnson. Thank you.
Episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll look into the case of a goat, a girl, and the rise of more compassionate and humane alternatives to 4-H agricultural programs. We'll be speaking with Danielle Hanisch, Executive Director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. It's a program that offers students the farm animal care experience and opportunities of 4-H without the selling of those animals for slaughter, which can traumatize many kids.
These kids were, 14, 15, 16 years old and just realizing, like someone flipped a switch that, oh my gosh, these animals are no different than my dogs and cats at home. And now I'm knee-deep in this program and I don't think that there's another option and I have to betray my friend who I have cared for.
We've got your goat. On the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, November 24th at 10 a.m., right here on 90.7 KBOO.